From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Moonlight Starlight by Virginia Laevsky. The genesis of the idea for the party was in an old Halloween costume Anne Carey found packed in a box in the attic. It had been made 30 years ago for a 7-year-old Anne by her mother. She had been a woman who threw nothing away. After Anne inherited the large Victorian spaces her mother had swept and garnished most of her life, she often came upon pieces of her own life, up until her marriage at least, neatly labeled and stored here or there. She was apt to find them on those first days of her husband's occasional absences, when she used house cleaning as a balm for initial loneliness. The costume she found that day was so beautifully sewn and carefully packed that its state of preservation was remarkable. When she shook out its folds, the coins which her mother had sewn individually on the bodice long ago clinked with a special sound that set up a painful little echo of disappointment in her forgetful heart. Though she remembered clearly then the smell of chrysanthemums and sewing machine oil in her mother's room the day the costume was fitted, she could not have said why the sound of the coins oppressed her with such a profound sense of loss. It had to do with a party she had lost, of course. It was to have been her very own. The games had been planned and the decorations made. Invitations had already been sent, due to the death by drowning of 2 small cousins in upstate New York. The party was canceled. The accident had happened the day before they were to leave to visit Anne. She had been broken-hearted, not for the cousins whom she had never seen, but for the party which was canceled. In time she was able to forget everything about it, but the sense of loss, which persisted unacknowledged up to day, when she opened the box to find the costume still waiting there. And that was the reason why Halloween became the occasion for the only really large children's party Anne Carey ever gave. She made a costume, less carefully done, for her 9-year-old son, and dressed her daughter in the gypsy outfit she herself was to have worn long ago. The party was a resounding success. Children, remembering it, asked her for months afterwards to give her another, but she never did, nor did she tell the reasons why it became the last children's party of any kind that she ever gave. The arrangement seemed so simple at first. She told her son, Bobby, he could invite the entire 4th grade with all its younger brothers and sisters. Games and refreshments were no problem. Now that Anne thought of it, she remembered the entire program of the beautiful party planned long ago. The bobbing for apples, followed by pin the tail on the donkey and musical chairs, marched through her mind in a succession almost as orderly and magical now as then. There would be none of the professional entertainment that had figured recently in some of the more ambitious neighborhood parties. What she wanted was a real old-fashioned Halloween party. It was something she was to repeat often during the week to the friends who called her with warnings and advice. Had she a first aid kit, she would probably need one, and be sure to omit the booby prizes. Children who won them were apt to weep, considering them a disgrace. The warnings began to include, unpleasantly often, the names of the Usher children. Everyone hoped they had not been invited, although on being questioned no one seemed able to tell Anne more than that they were considered strange. the rather menacing unknown quantity in the local algebra of human relationships. They were not much liked by other children. And then everyone knew how strange the parents were, living off by themselves as they did, never associating with anyone. Had she seen a father's work? Gruesome decadent stuff that no one who hadn't a morbid streak would think of painting. And according to rumors, it was just as well they did keep to themselves. It seemed Usher had a sense of humor that, to say the least, was sardonic. It could be they had heard very ugly at times. By that time, however, it was too late. The older children, the girl was in the fourth grade. She and her brother had been invited along with the rest. On Halloween, Anne, where their two children stood in the golden porch light, welcoming their guests. The children in various disguises began to come shortly after dark. They all seemed to arrive at the same time, coming out of the gloomy old-fashioned lane like a small army of faceless grotesques. Every child was masked. For an instant, Anne felt invaded by a force of nameless, not necessarily friendly strangers. Only the shadows of parents, coming from the obscurity into familiarity, assured her that beneath the grinning skull or monstrous face was a dimple or a freckled nose she knew. The party had become a reality at last. Each adult whispered instructions of various sorts to each small mystery at his side before setting it free to join its wriggling, hopping contemporaries. As they took leave of Anne with compliments and thanks, there was an unmistakable look of relief on most of their departing faces. She had said she could manage alone, even with her husband absent on business for his firm. By 8 o'clock, when the party hats had been passed out and the last parent had gone, almost everyone who had been invited was there. The party began in good order. They all pinned the tail on the donkey, waited patiently, good children all in a line. Each child was blindfolded and sent with cardboard tail in hand towards the donkey on the wall. Only one very young black cat, anonymous to Anne, cried because it had pinned its particular tail to the donkey's nose. It was quite easily comforted. The second game passed gaily, even hilariously. The children unmasked as they went to the big tin washbowl full of apples floating on top of the water that filled it. At the sight of laughter on small faces, freed so recently from the horrors which had hidden them from sight, Anne was charmed with a sudden feeling of felicity. The children, hands held behind their backs, bobbed for the apples. She watched them, holding to her moment with a sweet satisfaction of fulfillment. Down to the last detail, from the sound of the children's shrill, excited voices to the orange and black crepe papers and balloons, the festive smell of candle wax, heating the pulpy pumpkin, she had her party at last. It was well that she held to the moment, listening to the laughter, seeing the children's warm cheeks and tender, perspiring necks, her own daughter thrilled awareness of her multicolored petticoats. For shortly after that, the party began to change. It started during the next game, which was musical chairs, and at first it was almost imperceptible. Perhaps because it was the third rather strenuous game of the evening, Anne noticed some of the children showing signs of being overtired. Some of the smaller ones' cheeks were too flushed or pale. They had put the chairs in a row themselves, working rather wildly with some petty wrangling. There were quarrels in the air before they even started, and at the same time, something else. An odd feeling of restlessness and distraction, as though their minds were somewhere else. Watching them march around the chairs and the way each scrambled for a place once the music stopped, Anne decided she never had liked the game. It demanded a ruthlessness in the end that she found unpleasant, disliking the ultimate winner. She was glad when it was over, and she had settled the children to making funny men and animals out of the marshmallows, gumdrops, and toothpicks she had set out on card tables. A drooping rabbit's ear, a cat's tail hanging from its owner down the back of a chair, a worn sneaker sticking out beneath a ghost shroud, seemed charming to her still. And yet, she felt less delighted than before. The room became quiet enough for her to hear the children's labored breathing as they concentrated on their efforts. As they reached for the colored candles to fit them awkwardly on the toothpicks, Anne was not able to get rid of the slight depression settling over her. There was that furtive, restless quality creeping about the room, as though all the small figures bending over their nonsense were less intent than they pretended to be. There was a sense of shifting, of lifting the head to listen, though no child did these things. In the near silence, she heard the wind rising outside. It was then, too, that she heard the front gate creak as it opened. No child looked up. As Anne listened for the footsteps, which should have sounded on the porch afterward, each child seemed to concentrate more obliviously than before. When Anne crossed the room to the entrance hall, she felt she was being watched. It was such a strange feeling. She turned to look back. No one had even seen her go. Nothing but the wind rushing into the hall like some belated guest met her at the open door. Behind it, in darkness that crept away from the porch light, she could see no one. It was when her eyes searched the old garden at the side of the house that she saw them. They were standing by a small stone sundial Anne's grandfather had set there 3 years ago. A boy and a girl, hand in hand, they stood looking at her, motionless as it was. Not until she called to them, inviting them inside, did they move forward. As they came through the dark up the porch steps, Anne felt at last how truly starless the night was, how like these particular parents to send them out alone. They passed in silence through the door she held open for them. Once inside the hall, they waited, making no move towards the living room, standing always together in their peculiar stillness. Anne, for some reason unknown, not only closed but bolted the door. They were staring wordlessly up at her when she turned back to them. She found herself struggling with a feeling of aversion for them, since now that they had arrived she realized how relieved she had been earlier at their absence. The girl was a head taller than her brother, though both were identically costumed. Neither of them was masked, yet it was only one face that both turned to her, the boy's being simply a smaller version of the girl's. To Anne they had the look of having been drawn by their father instead of procreated in the usual way. She thought she even recognized Usher's personal style in the deliberate exaggeration of line and the faintly corrupt, half-graceful proportions of that face with its twofold glance. The eyes in particular were as overly large as the ones he painted. They were a flat tobacco brown. It was to that expression in them that she owed her feeling of aversion, for both pairs held a fixed, impersonal intentness that was less childlike, she thought, than inhuman. Still, they were only children, just come to a strange house. Anne, feeling slightly guilty, pointed the way to the living room. They walked ahead of her, docilely enough, not seeming to notice when Anne, following them, suddenly stopped still. She had noticed at last what they were wearing. She felt a sense of affront, of somehow being publicly insulted. If friends had called Usher's humor unpleasant and sardonic, she had not known up until then what those words could mean, for even to Anne, no authority on such matters, it was obvious he had sent them dressed in costumes representing the grave clothes of children of a past generation. Both wore on their heads wreaths of stiff formal leaves and were dressed in folds of white cloth from shoulder to foot. The costumes were draped delicately and, from a distance at least, looked as beautifully sewn as their own child's dress. that each detail had the stamp of conscious artistic effect only added to the cynical horror of the idea. Though the other children looked up as they entered the room, they remained sitting at their tables. Anne, sensing the general withdrawal on their part, came closer to her new guests, intending to reassure them. Close enough to the boy, in fact, to feel she had seen the worst ultimate point of the joke, for the material of their costumes had the limp suppleness of age. The hand-sewn lace on them was yellow. After their initial drawing back, the children began to speak again, to laugh, get up from the tables, and show her what they had made. They began a game of blind man's buff. It was not one of the games planned for the evening, but Anne took advantage of it to go away to privacy for a few moments. She stood alone in the gaily decorated dining room, with its rows of shining, waiting plates. She frowned, moving her lips slightly like a child over a mathematics problem, wondering uneasily how the children of such a father might be expected to behave. A need to see what was happening, as urgent as the need for privacy had been a few minutes before, sent her to the door of the room. What she saw reassured her. The two children, along with the others, crouched, hiding from the blindfolded child, who groped after them with outstretched hands. She saw the boy shrink away in his turn from the blind man, giggling softly. His eyes were shining childishly. She reproached herself. Yet the party was changed. The mood of it began to resemble more nearly the wild playouts of her childhood summer nights, when the long, soft dusk encouraged a feeling of lawlessness, of perilous emotions, a sort of childish debauch. There was a feverish, tense look on some of their faces. Anne had gone to the kitchen before the party went out of control. The children had begun to choose their own games by that time, and had been playing a comparatively quiet one when she left the room. It was an ancient game, a sort of ritual she remembered having played herself, known as Old Witch. "I'm going downtown to smoke my pipe, and I won't be back till Sunday night. And if you dare let the old witch in, I'll beat you red, white, and blue." A small voice chanted the words behind her as she entered the kitchen. For a time she busied herself pouring cider, warming plates, mentally counting heads as she concentrated on her own activities. Until the lights went out. The entire house was suddenly dark. Someone she knew had pulled a switch. When she called out anxiously, she was answered by her son's cheerful voice. They had decided, he called, to play Moonlight Starlight. The name, heard aloud, made a chill run over Anne. She hadn't thought of it for years. As a child, it had been the only game she had feared and hated. She felt intolerable anxiety as she wondered, while knowing at once who had suggested it. The party was out of hand. She groped across the kitchen to the drawer that led to her husband's flashlight, disguising her unreasonable fear with irritation at her son for pulling the switch without permission. Someone had taken and forgotten to return the flashlight. As she turned away, trying to think where she had put candles, she was remembering against her will the way the game was played. For Moonlight Starlight was an outdoor game, another part of the summer nights. Children played it only after dark. Anne remembered it well. The child who was it, the ghost, hid in some dark and secret place. Each child, separate and alone, had to wander in search of it. On finding it, they too became ghosts, until at last only one child was left to wander alone, watched by all the secret ghosts who would in the end pounce upon it. There were no candles. She set out in darkness. The switchbox was located across the living room in an alcove which had been built in a small conservatory with French doors opening into the garden. Even in the blackness of the hall, Anne knew exactly where it was. The house, except for small sounds and sudden scamperings, was silent. It seemed to take a long time to walk the length of the hall. In darkness, the house grew larger, as large as she had thought it as a child. And now, more nearly child than adult, she walked forward with dread. At any time now, it, changed from the familiar playmate to some nameless horror, could jump suddenly upon her from its hiding place. For like it or not, she too was a player now. Her hand touched the living room wall, and she groped forward, angry with herself for the way she shrank against it. She had reached the doors leading to the conservatory before she heard the whispering. It came from inside the room, and there was a quality in it that froze her motionless, hardly breathing. For a few seconds, her faculties were turned inward on her own pounding heart. It was only gradually, as she realized she had not been noticed, that she calmed somewhat. She found she was able to see dimly the three small figures standing inside. The white garments of two of them even shone slightly, though so little light came from the night which waited outside in the garden. When she was able to hear something beside her own pulse, she listened to the phrase the two in white whispered again and again, distinguishing at last the words, "Come out, come out into the dark, come with us." They whispered it together, excited, persuasive, with an urgent secret sibilance that beheld an increasing seductiveness at each repetition. The third child, so enticed, whimpered once and stood quiet between them after that. It had been the small sound of an animal, so full of fear as to be beyond outcry. It released Anne from the fear that held her, for the voice had been her daughter's. Though she leapt forward, she made no attempt to reach her child. Her urge was a primitive, overwhelming one for light to chase away the darkness. The hands that had fumbled so often before moved with the speed and sureness of fear which is beyond panic. And if the taller of the two, the girl swayed gently towards her with smiling teeth, at the same time lights blazed throughout the house, and her own child was in her arms. They stood alone in the class enclosed room. Other players, who had been wandering about downstairs, blinked their eyes in the sudden light, calling reproachful questions. Every child had come back into the living room before Anne, with trembling hands, shut the French doors, which had been swinging open in the wind from the garden. No child asked where two of the guests had gone. No one mentioned them at all through the final stages of the party. Anne, having had to choose between illness and anger, chose rightly. It was anger that sustained her through the refreshments, the collecting of coats, and the arrival thanks and goodbyes of parents. It was faithful through the night. She went to bed angry, and it was with her when she woke the next morning. She guarded it carefully as she planned the call she would make to Usher that day, since if she lost it, she feared what might take its place. In the end, it was Mrs. Usher who called Anne first. She had a pleasant voice, crisp and courteous, though rather impersonal sounding. She called, she said, to explain why her children had not been able to attend the party. They had had fever all day, and she believed it might be developing into a light case of chickenpox. Both she and they had been so disappointed. She had made their costumes herself. They were to have gone as a cat and a mouse. The voice seemed to fade out on the next few sentences. At the first words, Anne heard there had been a slight sickening wrench somewhere inside her. It was a relatively mild one, considering that it was the displacement of whatever held her being secure in its particular place in the universe. The voice wanted to know if most of the other children had been able to make it. Some of them, it knew, had had to come a long way. The invitations had been on orange paper. She remembered them. Her mother had let her cut out and address them herself, guiding her hand as it made fat wavering letters on the envelopes. She had been so proud that they were to go all the way to upstate New York. Anne's voice, when she answered, was steadier than the room, still wheeling crazily around herself and the telephone. "Yes," she said, "some of the children had to come a very long way." "Children would do almost anything not to miss a party," the voice said. "Yes," Anne said, "all the children had come."